explain.
As many of you may know, that Judge Rovner's husband passed this past weekend. So I think in honor of him, we'll all stand for a moment of silence. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Rovner will be participating by listening to the audio tapes of today's argument, and we'll conference at a later time. So with that, we'll proceed with the first case this morning, in re OJA. Mr. Bosch.
May it please the Court, good morning. Paul Bach and Carolina Salas for the appellants, Ernest and Beverly Ojeda. Your Honors, this case comes before you essentially on the second phase of an appeal. The original case was a non-dischargeability action brought in the bankruptcy proceeding of the Ojedas before Judge Squires, one of our bankruptcy judges, after a three-day trial where there were four witnesses who testified over that period. There was extensive documentary evidence, including financial records, as well as correspondence and other matters between the parties. Judge Squires issued an extensive memorandum opinion where he made numerous factual findings and ultimately determined that the plaintiff in the case had failed to meet its burden of proof on a number of issues. One, justifiable reliance under the standards set forth in Field v. Manns, the Supreme Court case. Two, that they had failed to prove damages pursuant to essentially a series of cases holding that, in fact, a forbearance, if fraudulently induced, could be grounds for a non-dischargeability claim, but only if there was a showing of the existence of a valuable collection remedy and a further showing that that remedy lost value during the period of the fraud that induced the forbearance. And finally, only to the extent of the loss in value. The final issue, which was the only legal issue presented, which was sort of a spin on the standard of forbearance, was if the court found, in fact, there was fraud and damages, what was the extent of the damages, or effectively, what amount of debt could be accepted from discharge? And the court, Judge Squires, held that only the interest, which accrued after the original loan, could be held subject to non-dischargeability because there was, in fact, no dispute that there was no fraud in connection with the original loan or any of the prior renewals. Because the case presents uniquely factual issues, the standard of review is important and we think determinative. And we think the district court erred in a number of respects. First, it made an interpretation of the bankruptcy court's opinion on justifiable reliance, which was not in the bankruptcy court's opinion. And secondly, with respect to the issue of damages, it essentially reweighed the evidence, selecting several pieces of evidence out of context without considering the full record and without essentially giving the deference to the fact finder that is deserved under the general standards of Anderson and I think were accepted, frankly, by all the courts in the case. And with respect to that, we noted in our brief the Bonnet case, 895 Fed Second, 1157, where the court makes clear when you're reviewing a second-tier appeal on factual issues, the review is not of the findings of the district court, whether the district court's findings were appropriate on the record, but in fact, you must review today whether the bankruptcy court's factual findings were clearly erroneous, and under the general standards that it could only be clearly erroneous if no reasonable person could have made the findings, if the bankruptcy judge's findings were a permissible view of the evidence, even if this court disagreed or even if the district court disagreed, it is not grounds to reverse. And essentially, I believe Judge Posner's famous quote was that unless the finding strikes us with the odor of a two-week-old dead fish, you simply cannot reverse. And particularly in a case like this, which was inherently factually intensive, at best you had mixed questions of law and fact that had to be applied here under the Rovell decision. Those you must defer to the bankruptcy court on that. There is no de novo review. And in all respects, we believe that there was certainly ample evidence before the bankruptcy court to support his findings. But the case begins, again, with Field versus Mads, which is the first element of proof that the bankruptcy court found that the appellees before you, the plaintiffs, failed to prove. Field versus Mads interpreted 523A2A of the bankruptcy code, which is the relevant section, as adopting essentially the common law standards of the various states when Congress adopted the original Reform Act in 1978. In effect, it rejected a reasonable person standard or community standard and said that basically justifiable reliance was a matter of the qualities and characteristics of the particular plaintiff in a particular case rather than an application of the community standards to all uses relying on the restatement of torts definition at Section 537. The court, however, made an important point by noting that this did not take reasonableness out of the equation. In effect, what the courts are required to do is look at the particular plaintiff. Is he unsophisticated, sophisticated? Look at the circumstances. And then with respect to those circumstances, and the court notes that justifiable reliance cuts both ways. A unsophisticated plaintiff is held to a lower standard. A more sophisticated plaintiff is held to a higher standard. And in this case, we had a very sophisticated plaintiff. We had an individual, Mr. Goldberg, who had been in law enforcement for many years, ran a multimillion-dollar company, was an active private lender, made lots of these high-risk, unconventional loans, and therefore the court, we think, appropriately applied a higher standard.
But when you look at the McClellan case and its discussion of reliance, doesn't reliance only become relevant when the fraud takes the form of an affirmative misrepresentation?
It does, and that was alleged here, Your Honor.
But the affirmative misrepresentation was what?
In this case, what they claim, it was the affirmative misrepresentation was a concealment of the sale of some McDonald's restaurants. And the court, again, the bankruptcy court considered that because what I think the error of the district court was the district court seemed to suggest the bankruptcy court imposed the duty of investigation on them to actually investigate and find out whether the McDonald's restaurants had sold. It did not do anything of the sort. What might have confused the district court is that originally there were two alleged concealments, one of a sale of a certain bank, which they have now abandoned at the district court, it's not before this court, and the other one was a sale of the McDonald's. And what the court, bankruptcy court, essentially found about the McDonald's was that you weren't justified in relying on them owning the McDonald's in the first place. The McDonald's were never part of the original loan transaction. There was nothing in the loan agreements. And again, they had a sophisticated lender represented by a sophisticated law firm. There was no prohibition on the sale of the McDonald's. There was no requirement that they give notice if they sold the McDonald's. There was no requirement that the proceeds of the McDonald's be paid to the debt or applied to the debt. They essentially, with respect to the McDonald's, they were an unsecured creditors. Over a period of 8 years that this transaction went on, there was never a single request for a financial statement. There was never anything that even Mr. Goldberg conceded that a reasonable lender should have done. And the court ultimately concludes that based on this complete inaction and indifference to the status of McDonald's restaurants and a specific finding that, in fact, what they were relying on was the timely payment of interest. And again, this is not a case where a debtor went in and got a loan and then didn't make a payment. They made over $800,000 in payments over an eight-year period. In fact, this is also not a case where this is not a no-asset case. The Goldbergs are likely to receive close to $250,000 in distributions from the Ojeda bankruptcy estate, and the Pelham bankruptcy estate was the related corporate case, which is mentioned in the opinion. So this is not a case like many others where someone went into the bank and then the bank got one payment and there was no payment. It went on over 8 years, and the bankruptcy court consider all those circumstances in making its finding. And that certainly is a permissible view of the evidence and one which under the applicable standards cannot be upset. And I think what's very instructive is if you look at Judge Breyer's dissent in the Field case, he noted there that what he thought the court was quibbling over was he agreed the majority had reached the right decision on justifiable reliance, but what he was concerned about is that they seemed to be quibbling over the use of justifiable and reasonableness. And what he was pointing out was that the bankruptcy court in that case, in fact, had applied the justifiable reliance standard, even though he used the wrong labels. But the court noted something important, which is consistent, again, with the majority's limitation, which says basically that reasonableness has a role because the further the distance between reasonable conduct and actual reliance, it's more likely that, in fact, there was no actual reliance. And what Judge Breyer noted was that when you have a typical plaintiff saying, well, I relied on the ownership, what he suggested was that the court should look for some objective corroboration to that claim because the primary purpose of justified reliance is to show, in fact, there was reliance. And what Judge Squires found here was basically based on the conduct over this period of time, in fact, there wasn't reliance or certainly justifiable reliance on the ownership of the McDonald's, and therefore whether they disclosed or didn't disclose was really irrelevant. And he found, as a matter of fact, that they were relying upon timely, prompt payment, which went on for a period of 8 years here. So that was a factual finding supported by the evidence. It's not subject to reversal. And I think I noted that the district court seemed to suggest that the bankruptcy court imposed a duty to investigate, but it did not with respect to the sale of McDonald's. It never said that you should have known about the McDonald's. Certainly there was lots of evidence in the record which would have supported that. The McDonald's restaurant was located a block off Michigan Avenue. The Ojedas, in fact, were on television promoting the restaurant. They never made any effort to conceal it. The issue of the fraud with the use of the old McDonald's checks, they used those checks, gave them to other creditors. So there certainly was evidence relating to that. But again, under the clearly erroneous standard, it's not for us on appeal to be able to challenge that because there's evidence going both ways. The other important issue before the court is the issue of damages. As I noted under 523A2A, the Supreme Court basically adopted the common law standards for fraud, which requires damages. And this issue was front and center in a recent case of the court in the Goldblatt's Bargain Stores case, where essentially the court held that fraud without damages is no fraud at all, and an absence of proof of damages at the trial court precludes any type of recovery. We agree with that case. We do disagree with the appellant's statement in its brief at page 28 that they only had to show they had valuable collection remedies to prove their case. That is not, in fact, what the two cases they rely on say. The Beetler case basically said the proof required was the creditor had valuable collection remedies at the time of the misrepresentation. The creditor did not exercise those remedies because of the fraud. And three, the remedies lost value during the time of the forbearance. In this case, there was no showing. The Goldbergs had no expert. They made no attempt to value the collection remedies at the time of the alleged fraud, and they certainly made no attempt to value or the collection remedies as they exist today, or essentially the loss in value. And certainly, under these types of tests, you have to have a beginning value and an ending value. Therefore, you end up with your damages. This is a fundamental principle of bankruptcy and valuation cases. In bankruptcy, we value claims. We value property every day. There was a wealth of financial information available. The bankruptcy court considered much of this and essentially did not, as the district court suggests, that they put on no evidence of the value of the remedies or no evidence of loss and value, but simply held that they had failed to meet their burden of proof again. And under the circumstance of this case where you had a complex intercreditor relationship, the Ojedas had many other creditors. They had many interests in different pieces of property. There was an issue with respect to the validity of the guarantee they had from the corporation, which frankly may have been lost or avoided by other creditors had they taken action in 04. There was the complicated question of the 1031 exchange, which would have resulted in a significant tax liability. The original financial statements the Goldbergs have showed that essentially the Pelham Enterprises had virtually no tax basis left in its assets, so almost the entire value of the sale was taxable gain. There were significant creditors of those entities that were paid. There was a distribution, ultimately, which resulted in essentially a small amount of money, which was then reinvested in another business, which the Ojedas did with the intention of making money. They weren't doing this because they thought they were going to lose all their money. And, in fact, the court references the Pelham decision where there was a significant recovery by the bankruptcy trustee against the sellers of that business based on various claims. So in that situation, if you even ignoring the proof on the other points, there simply was no evidence of damages here. And the idea that, well, inferential proof was okay, or Mr. Ojeda's testimony was he was in better financial shape, In cases before the courts, we must quantify our damages. We just can't come in and say we must have suffered some loss, which is essentially what the district court did. The district court pointed at the three pieces of evidence. The Ojedas had a house. They took out a second mortgage to put into Joey Bona's business. Some of that money, in fact, went to the Goldbergs. During the period of the alleged forbearance, the Goldbergs received about $120,000 in additional payments, which came from these sources. There was a suggestion about the 1031 exchange. There was some money that was used to pay other creditors. Well, a lot of those other creditors are their business creditors. Those claims, in fact, are deductible, and the district court was mistaken in its belief that those weren't deductible claims. What wasn't deductible and what was taxable out of the 1031 exchange was any money that would have been distributed to the Ojedas to pay the Goldbergs.
You say the Goldbergs received $100,000+ in addition to the monthly payments on the loan?
Your Honor, during the course, they invoiced monthly. The McDonald's was sold on October 1st of 2004. They received interest payments until, I think, through December of the following year. So they received approximately another 14 or 15 interest payments. They were approximately $9,000 a month. So they continued. In fact, the alleged fraud in this case was the payments by the checks. So during this whole period, they're getting money. So essentially, we can account for at least $120,000 of the money is going to the Goldbergs.
Couldn't the Ojedas have used the money they spent to buy Joey's Pizzeria to pay the debt to the Goldbergs?
Your Honor, had they done that, they would not have been able to take advantage of the 1031 exchange. That would have triggered a tax liability of close to $1 million. And as I think we put out in our briefs, assume, for example, that the Goldbergs had found out about the sale. They couldn't prevent the sale, and they concede that. So the sale would have closed on October 1st, and they took action to stop the reinvestment. That would have triggered the tax event for the Ojedas. If they would have filed for bankruptcy, the government would have had a $1 million tax claim ahead of the Goldbergs. Remember, the Goldbergs are simply an unsecured creditor.
Thank you, Mr.
I see my time is up. Thank you, Mr.
Kimball.
Good morning, Your Honors. Stuart Gimbel on behalf of the appellee, Gail Goldberg. There are three issues in the case. First of all, addressing your question, Judge Williams, this was a false pretenses case. It wasn't a fraudulent misrepresentation case. So the question of reliance and what the proper standard is an open one. However, we have argued the case on the basis that the justifiable reliance standard would be applicable in this case in any event. It's certainly not going to be the higher reasonable reliance standard. I'm going to skip over reliance for a moment and go to the question of the proximate cause of damages, because Your Honor asked a question, couldn't the money have been used that was taken from the Starker Trust to buy the Joey Bonas Pizzeria to pay off the Goldberg debt? Clearly the answer is yes. Counsel's answer that there was a $1 million tax liability is not founded in the record. There's nothing in the record that says that. In fact, the district court looked at the testimony of Mr. Ojeda with respect to the issue of the dire tax consequences, and she said under 1031, the only thing that is deferred is the money that is put into the like-kind transaction Starker account. And therefore, the only thing that could have been subject to taxation would have been the approximately $1.15 million that was put into the Starker account. Now, there's no doubt that if the Ojedas had elected, instead of taking the proceeds of the sale of their McDonald's stores and used it to pay off Gail Goldberg, they would have had to pay capital gains taxes on that $1.15 million. But as the district court said, that would have left plenty of money to pay off the Goldberg indebtedness. The problem here isn't that they didn't have enough money to pay off the Goldbergs. The problem is they didn't have enough money to pay off the Goldbergs and to buy the shiny new restaurant that they wanted to buy to use as the centerpiece of their retirement plan. Now, what happened here was basically they made Gail Goldberg the unknowing investor in their new pizza restaurant. She had invested in the Goldbergs, in the Ojedas, She had been receiving a stream of interest payments. Both her and her husband had understood that the Ojedas had owned these McDonald's stores, and they were very impressed by that fact. And they were impressed by the fact that the McDonald's stores, including what Mr. Ojeda said was the biggest volume store in the Chicagoland area in 2004, was the kind of assets that would throw off money that could pay the indebtedness. So as long as they thought that those McDonald's stores were owned, they knew they were safe. Although there is no issue here regarding the existence of the false pretenses, just a reminder here, at the time that the Ojedas sold their McDonald's stores, not only did they not tell Gail Goldberg about the sale of the stores, but they then went and sent her only checks from one of their two entities, which kept referencing the McDonald's information that gave the false impression that they were still affiliated, and that's why Judge Squires found that there were false pretenses in this concealment of the sale. Going to the question of the proximate cause of damages, the standard...
Can you go back just a minute and spend a little time, because I'm trying to look at this damage award and see if it's appropriate. Let me ask you this question. How much money could the Goldbergs have recovered if they had terminated the loan in October of 2004 after the McDonald's had been sold?
Well, let's look at what assets we know of in the record. First of all, you have the $1.15 million that went into the Starker. We already talked about that. There was also another approximately $1.1 million out of the proceeds of the sale of the McDonald's that didn't go into the Starker account. The evidence was that there was, I believe, a little over $700,000 that was wired into the Ojeda's Pelham account, and then there was another $438,000 that was wired into the Dicey's account. Now, the argument that's been made by the Ojedas is that that money was used to wind down the business and it was used to pay taxes. However, if you look at Exhibit X in this case, which is the list, which is all of the Dicey's checks that were written after October of 2004, you will see that there was $144,000 of checks out of the Dicey's Inc. account that was paid to the Ojedas, including $40,000 of checks that were paid to Beverly Ojeda on October 1st, 2004, when the money came in from the sale. They weren't, it's not that they didn't have money to pay the Goldbergs, they just didn't want to.
And that amount would have been, in your opinion, would have been the full $600,000.
Well,
let's assume they had that money and it would, you know, are you saying that you would be entitled to the $600,000 or would it be the $600,000 minus the interest that had already been paid?
Well, I think we would be entitled to recover the principal balance. The interest was being paid, so that's not owed. There will be interest after February of 2006 that continued to go forward at that point. We're dealing here with a fraudulently induced extension case. And so when you're dealing with a fraudulently induced extension case, the question is, what is the standard that you use to determine how a person was harmed by that extension? Judge Squires acknowledged that there was a fraudulent inducement of this that was akin to an extension here. However, he said that because the original indebtedness had not been caused by the fraud, the only thing that could be recovered in the non-discharge would be the interest and attorney's fees. That's incorrect. As Judge Gottschall ruled, what we are dealing here, the term to the extent obtained by, under the McClellan case, it said that modifies the term money, property, or services, or extension, renewal, or refinance. What the court said in McClellan is that to the extent obtained by doesn't modify the term debt. And in fact, it doesn't make sense, I think the court said, to talk about obtaining a debt. A debt isn't something that somebody obtains. So the question then is, was the extension obtained by the fraud, the false pretenses, and to what extent was it obtained by the false pretenses? as Judge Gottschall said, clearly Gail Goldberg wasn't saying, I'm only going to forbear from collecting interest or I'm only going to forbear from collecting attorney's fees. What Gail Goldberg said was, I feel comfortable knowing that they own the McDonald's stores, so I am going to forbear from collecting the entire indebtedness. And therefore, the extension was obtained by the fraudulent conduct to the full extent of the forbearance. And that's what needs to be subject to the discharge. Now, let's go back to the question of how much money would have been available in October 2004.
So under your theory, then this $112,000 that they paid after October of 2004, they would get no credit on that as it relates to the principal.
That's correct. That was just the interest, Your Honor. Going back to how much money would have been available to them in October of 2004, the standard under the Beetler case that Mr. Bach talked about seems to be accepted by everybody as the applicable standard for fraudulently induced extensions, and that is you have to show you had valuable remedies, that you failed to exercise those valuable remedies because of the fraud, and that the remedies lost value. There's no doubt that Gail Goldberg established a prima facie case. The fact that she didn't exercise her remedies was something that was found by Judge Squires, who found that she relied upon the false pretenses and the false impressions by not calling the loan in October of 2004. There's no question that by February of 2006, the financial situation was much worse for the Ojedas. Mr. Ojeda testified that his investment in Joey Bonas was crashing, that they were losing substantial amounts of money. In fact, Exhibit M, Plaintiff's Exhibit M, is a letter dated February 10th from Mr. Ojeda to the Goldbergs saying, we've experienced a serious financial setback. So clearly their position was worse in February of 2006 than it was in October of 2004 when they were at their financial apex. They had just sold their two McDonald's restaurants for $5.1 million, had grossed $2.3 million from those sales, and were sending people on vacations and paying off hundreds of thousands of dollars to themselves to pay off their loans while not paying off the loan to Gail Goldberg. There are other assets out there as well that would have been available to Gail Goldberg in October of 2004. As Judge Gottschall found, besides the $1.5 million that was in the Starker that could have been used to pay, and the other $1.1 million that had been distributed out that they were using to pay themselves and to keep their managers on full salary and benefits for 6 months during the transition period so that they could start their new venture, there was also equity in the Ojeda's house. They testified that they had between $300,000 and $350,000 of equity in their house in October of 2004. And when Joey Bonas started experiencing financial difficulties, they took a second mortgage on that, took the money out, and invested that into the Joey Bonas restaurant instead of using that money to pay off Gail Goldberg. And as we know, they ended up losing that in addition to the $1.1 million out of the Starker Trust that they had invested. The problem here is that they thought that they were making a decision that made economic sense for themselves, but they didn't let Gail Goldberg make the decision for herself whether she wanted to back their ownership of the Joey Bonas Pizza restaurant or, knowing that they had sold their McDonald's restaurants, she wanted to cash out and get her money back.
But there was no indication in the initial transaction, that McDonald's played any part in that loan, right?
Well, it was on the personal financial statement that was given at the time that they entered into the loan, and there was testimony from Mr. Goldberg that he went out and called a friend of his from McDonald's and ascertained. So there was clearly some reliance upon their ownership. Mr. Bach is right. There was no due-on-sale clause or anything, and nobody is saying that the Ojedas weren't allowed to sell their McDonald's. What we were saying and what Judge Squires found is you're not allowed to sell your McDonald's not tell us about it, and then deceive us by sending us checks that would imply your continued ownership of those McDonald's so that we think you own the McDonald's so that we don't call the note. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.